This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Yellowstoners, a podcast dedicated to getting high on drama, digging into the Duttons, and everything Yellowstone, hosted by editor-in-chief of The Playlist, Rodrigo Perez, and myself, Mike D'Angelo. We are back this week to talk about episode 6 of the series that aired this past Sunday on the Paramount Network. And after that discussion, we get to talk with actor Jefferson White, who joins us to talk about, you know, playing Jimmy Herdstrom, the beloved Jimmy Herdstrom from the show, hosting the brand new official Yellowstone Companion podcast, which launches its first episode this Thursday, December 9th. We won't hold that against him. But before we jump into Yellowstoning, I've got to tell you that the Yellowstoners is part of the Playlist Podcast Network, which includes the Playlist Podcast, The Discourse, Be Real, Deep Focus, The Fourth Wall, and more. Like and subscribe on any of your podcast apps of choice. To drop us a comment on iTunes, as we always do. Appreciate it. Okay, Rodrigo, it feels like the gas is finally being turned up on the season a little bit more with this episode 6. I know you haven't been a huge fan of the season so far, but what are your overall thoughts on what we saw with episode 6?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked episode 6, and I thought it was definitely the best of the season so far. And It had some of the real good shit that I really liked. It was funny. Like you said, the gas and the match has been lit, and now we're like cooking with grease, and it seems like we're going, and some good shit's happening. And so, yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, I think this back half of the season is going to be pretty eventful. Yeah, considering they're already letting out a lot of different things going. Specifically, I did not see, you know, the Lloyd and Walker stuff, one, being something that I was engaged with, and two, I didn't see the stabbing coming. Did you see the big stab coming?
I mean, no, like at first when, like, you know, like when it was being teased, like last week or the previous week or whenever it was like, I was like, oh, this again. And I was like, Lloyd's like, all of a sudden, it's like kind of like what we've been talking about this show. It's sort of like this delay of dealing with your feelings kind of thing. Right.
Right.
And so like Lloyd is finally like had it, and he's sort of estranged from everyone in the bunkhouse. It's a little bit annoying because it's sort of like you're dealing with your feelings like 3 or 4 episodes later, but they deal with it in a pretty satisfying way. And I sort of kind of get it in a way, because there's only so much you can stick into each episode. So it's kind of like this more like, you know, television has like an A, B, C, D storyline thing going on. And I might argue that Yellowstone has like maybe an A through F kind of thing going on, and maybe, you know, or even G, and like they rotate some of those in and out. So you might get an A, a C, an E, and a G in one episode, and then, you know what I mean? And then some, so it comes back, and then it comes back a little bit later, and some they're not dealt with right away, but they're not quite gone either.
Yep.
So it's a little bit of just juggling that kind of stuff. And, you know, the stabbing was kind of a bit much. like it was kind of crazy, but the fight kind of got out of control. So it was kind of nuts, but I, you know, we can get into the particulars of that, but I think that whole storyline ended up being my favorite part of that whole episode. And the way, you know, Lloyd was dealt with, the way, you know, again, all that stuff about loyalty and Rip being like, you know, damn you for, making me do this. And this kind of like, you know, and he tells him, I love you. And then he just fucks him up. Like, oh, that stuff is just like really brutal.
Yeah. And you got to wonder, what has he done to still be alive? Because they would have killed literally everybody else.
What has Lloyd done?
Yeah. What the hell is Lloyd? How is he alive? Because everyone else would have died.
Because he's been on that ranch forever.
Yeah.
He's an old man now. And he's been basically Rip before Rip and was a reliable ranch hand for like decades, probably.
Yeah. You know? I was just wondering if there was a specific event or two that maybe has John a little more reluctant to give him up.
Probably, given that, like, you know, if you think about the show and the events that happen, there's always something.
Yeah.
But I think it just in general, it's probably also just the fact that, like, you know, Lloyd's probably been branded for like 20 years now or something, right? And and he's probably been, you know, he's been the total veteran sort of stalwart, reliable guy. And so, yeah, he definitely fucks up in a major fucking way. But I guess they were kind of setting the stage for that a little bit, you know, him hanging out with the kid and feeling estranged from everyone, sort of the glaring looks. He's kind of just fucking reached his boiling point with Walker and the girl sort of just jumping around to different men in the bunkhouse.
Yeah. And now they're supposedly kicked out, but as far as I can tell, they're not. And they're still around.
Yeah. Yeah. Although I think that probably gets, resolved or something comes to a head. But yeah, there's some really good shit in that. The whole just like John Dutton's speech to Lloyd and what things between him and Rip. And, you know, like those rivers run deep, you know,
between
these guys, you know. So people like that do get a lot of second chances. And it's funny, you know, we talk about, you know, a lot of some of the stuff is like Godfather-esque or whatever. And on those kinds of narratives, like, you know, those people don't get second chances. They're just fucked, you know.
Yep.
They're thrown in, like, you know, they sleep with the fishes, you know. here, you know, there's a little bit more leeway for people. And, you know, even John giving, you know, Jimmy all these extra chances is kind of a sort of shows his empathy and like his sort of fatherly nature. Like, yes, he can be a ruthless, horrible man, but like, I mean, he doesn't owe Jimmy shit. He's known Jimmy for like basically a fucking year, you know?
Yep.
It's kind of interesting that, you know, that sort of dichotomy of like cruelty, but empathy and compassion, right? It's sort of like, it's that again, another kind of ebb and flow. And again, another thing I really just like about the show in general. It would be easy to have people just be fucking cruel motherfuckers and be like, fuck you, you know?
Yeah. But Succession.
yeah. But it's never kind of quite like that because, you know, at the end of the day, the Duttons and John Dutton specifically sort of looks at the whole ranch as a kind of big, like, family ecosystem, right? With like a lot of people with their parts to play. And as much as he can be like, all right, that person's out or whatever, he can also like kind of understand that a lot of people have their parts to play and sort of need to be in place. Otherwise, certain things fall apart. Obviously, some people are just, you know, disposable, other people are not. So I really liked all that bunkhouse stuff and I thought it was really good.
I'm still hoping that after this point, there's not a lot of Lloyd and Walker feuding because I think we've had our fill, don't you think?
Yes, definitely. And I would assume that, I mean, fucking Lloyd pulls out a switchblade and stabs him in the fucking chest. and then he has to get basically put back together by a veterinarian because they can't take Walker to the hospital because they don't report shit like that. This kind of stuff is sort of like, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the bunkhouse stays in the bunkhouse. So I would assume that at this point, you know, they beat the shit out of each other in this episode, right? Like
yeah, they do.
John's whole thing is let's, you know, let them beat the shit out of each other until there's no beating the shit out of each other left to do. Like they just like they just get it out of the way, and you know, and then there's the minor spoiler, I guess, you know, like Rip breaks Lloyd's hand at the end of the whole fight and he says I love you, and it's sort of like I think he says something like you know, I do this because I love you, because he's trying to say like, look, I'm trying to stop you from fucking up your life here.
Yeah.
I'm breaking your hand and I'm going to make that. And not only is that painful in this moment, but it's going to make your job harder over the next few weeks. And it's going to be a reminder for you that like, you need to know your place here. And as much as you're one of the top dogs in the bunkhouse, you're still kind of like a worker at the end of the day. And this is your last fucking chance. And if you don't fucking remember, like, you know, hopefully this hand, your hand is going to be a constant reminder of your fucking recent trespass. And, you know, it's just kind of that kind of cowboy kind of way, you know, it's cruel, but it's compassionate at the same time too. Right. Because he says, I love you, but then he fucking steps on his hand and fucking breaks it. It's also brutal. Yeah, yeah. It's interesting.
Let's jump over to some of the Beth stuff before we get to the big Jamie stuff that has happened in this episode. I will just say last episode, I did call that Summer was going to be a near-death victim of Beth as soon as she found her in the house. And it did happen in this episode right away. And a lot of great quotes were had right away. Dad, if you're going to hire a hooker, would you please let me get you a good one, was probably one of my faves coming out of Beth's mouth.
Immediately when she finds Summer, who's played by Piper Barabo, who has sex with John and hooks up with John, and she sees him the next day when she comes to the house and John and Summer are having breakfast. She basically just fucking loses her shit and goes to town. And, you know, there's that line, I hope you die of ass cancer. There's just like, just like Beth goes, Beth's like, insults her boobs that she has none, and mm-hmm. it just like gets really relentless. It's bordering on almost Beth writing parody, but it's pretty good. One of the things I thought was so ridiculous but sort of still comical at the same time, like I was laughing my ass off, was that when Summer is the character who is an animal rights activist, and so she in some ways is in complete conflict with John Dutton, but then when she gets to know him a little bit better and see how, you know, he cares for the animals and the land and the environment and all of Montana, she understands that she has more in line with him than she initially thought, which is why they probably hook up. Like they're actually less at odds than they both assume at first, and that starts to flower their, I guess, relationship or hookup or whatever it is so far. And then so she's of course vegan, and when she tries to have breakfast at the table, and I don't remember his cook, but you know, there's that character who plays the Dutton family cook. He doesn't really say much, but you know, except for things around breakfast, and it's like yes sir or whatever and all this stuff. But it became, she's like, you know, does it have gluten? And he's like, what's gluten? Like, he's never heard of gluten. Like, it's like, I don't know whether Taylor Sheridan is like trying to be funny or he really, really thinks that people don't like, I think the guy says like, I don't know what vegan is. He doesn't know, like, the guy is like, he just keeps going, what's that? What's that? To like everything she says about any of that stuff. And as someone who is not any of those things at all, I at least have heard of them before, you know? Yeah.
He would have had to have been trained on the Dutton Ranch in only Dutton cooking to not understand what the hell's going on.
Yeah, it was comical and silly almost that a character would be like that, but I did get a pretty good laugh out of it.
Yeah, it was definitely a fish out of water kind of moment for Summer. And then Beth has another moment this later in the episode where she pretty much proposes to Rip. She basically tells him they're getting married and likely, you know, she wants him to pick a place that nobody else has been to, that kind of thing. So that's kind of a big moment for them to officially acknowledge that, you know, this is forever.
I do also kind of like, I love the way their dynamic works with the bunkhouse, because I think at one point she asks him like, what happened? And obviously massive crazy drama at the bunkhouse. And he's like, nothing.
Cowboy shit.
Because like, it's funny the way he separates his life like that. Like to him at his day job, you know, that thing, the biggest fucking hugest drama happened. But to her, it's like, honey, don't worry about it. This is like low hanging fruit bullshit that I'm not even going to bother explaining to you, because it's like, in, you know, it's like what we have is so much more important than that. It's just kind of interesting, you know, because it is, the bunkhouse is his everything, but compared to Beth, it's still kind of nothing, you know?
Right. And if he did tell Beth what was going on, she would tune out in about 3 seconds.
Yeah, that's also probably true, right? But I just found that kind of funny that he was just like, nothing, don't worry, cowboy shit. Like stupid shit that you don't probably give a shit about.
And then, oh yeah, we got Casey's family. They're settling in. They found a house and a dog that came with the house that they're just calling dog for now. But yeah, there's been other things that he's looking into, like these multiple Mustangs that were disappearing off the reservation. And that brings right. back.
I got to say that whole subplot with his wife and the girl. Oh, that's stupid.
I don't understand what they're trying to do here by giving him like a secondary love interest or someone to stir the relationship up.
It is really one of those things, like the worst part of the show where you have to create a drama to create a drama just to have one going. Mm-hmm. It's like you're always like, I mean, a TV definitely does that where it's like, you know, you're spinning plates. Every one of your A, B, C, D, E, G, whatever stories are your a plate that you're spinning. And then, you know, you go over to the next one and one looks like it's going to stop spinning and fall down. You spin it harder again, right? And so you amp up the drama. That's the kind of what they do in all TV shows. But man, some of them are just really kind of baffling and silly sometimes. And so, you know, post Casey's family almost getting killed at the beginning of the episode, she doesn't want to live there. So they move, they find this own their own place, not that far away in this gorgeous fucking little vista, little valley. And, but then they throw this stupid thing in there where one of the other indigenous Native American women who used to be on the ranch in like what, season two or season three or something?
Yeah, that was season two.
For a quick minute, and then she just left. She resurfaces, and she happens to be she's part of the family that got a bunch of their Mustang horses stolen. So it's just sort of a coincidence, and they're like, oh, hey, I know you, right? But then she's like falling for him in this really kind of embarrassing kind of way.
Very blatant.
And then, but even before she does any of that, Monica keeps going like, oh, so who's the cute girl, huh? Why is the cute? And it just becomes this sort of like ridiculous kind of thing. Like, first of all, it just seems like Monica's like being ridiculous for no reason. But then we sort of see later on that she is kind of like, I don't know, that part of it is, I'm trying to like think, does the Mustangs and who stole them or got rid of them, is that going somewhere? Or was that just an excuse to bring this girl back into the fold and create some sort of romantic tension conflict? Because
I'm wondering if it ties back into the California people that he, you know, threw under the cattle.
Maybe
girders or whatever.
Maybe. That's interesting, but I can't remember the name of that other Native American girl.
Avery.
Avery. Right. Right. And she was cool. I liked that character. I was bummed to see her gone.
But I don't remember her too much from season two. I know she had a thing with Jimmy a little bit, but I don't remember anything with Casey.
No, there was nothing. They barely even knew each other. They just sort of recognized, they at best, you know, he recognized her. Oh, hey, you, I know you from the bunkhouse. What are you doing out here kind of thing? But yeah, I thought that was pretty silly. I don't know. I guess we'll see where that goes, but that wasn't my favorite.
Yeah, I do like the new home and the dog and, you know, everything that he's setting up there. But it just kind of like feels really weird throwing in a whole other love interest into the pot.
Yeah, again, it seems like conflict for the sake of conflict. Like there's a storyline, but then like, so the storyline is they've moved, they find a new, you know, a new house, all this stuff. But then you've got to sort of throw something negative on top of it. I don't know. It's sort of frustrating. And it's kind of the frustrating thing about the show and maybe the frustrating thing about television in general, how they just got to spice up some conflict or find it or manufacture it in ways that don't always feel
organic,
genuine or organic. Yeah.
Especially because Monica and Casey have plenty to be at odds with at this point in time. It's not like they couldn't write up something that is more organic. Well, I guess we'll see where it leads, and hopefully not down the alley of just like buy Monica, whatever that is.
I'm sure not. You know, he's too loyal for that. And yeah, and I'm still a little curious about what they think they're doing with this.
Yeah, me too. All right, so let's talk about Garrett Randall and Jamie's big confrontation, because Jamie, you know, he pulls out a gun on him. He tells him to get his hands behind his back, tries to confront him about the hit. And he's pretty upfront. He doesn't try to deny it. He doubles down. He says he's going to do it again, if anything. And the only person that Jamie really protests when he's kind of talking about people is Casey. The rest of them, it doesn't seem like he really cares about.
Yeah, but he still does, but you know, we did get our confirmation in this episode that, you know, Jamie went to go speak to that that guy in prison, that Riggins guy, gave him immunity and asked him, you know, to talk about, you know, whether his father, Garrett Randall, put out the hit, and, you know, that's confirmed. And, you know, he talked about all about that, right? Like, yep, the whole, yeah, I did it and I'll do it again. And, you know, all this other shit. And then Christina, his ex-girlfriend from like a previous, from I think season two, mm-hmm, comes back with their child. Yeah. So that's interesting because, yeah, I guess I had sort of predicted Jamie was going to immediately renounce him. And while he does pull a gun on him and all that stuff, like, it's more complicated than that. And Garrett bringing, you know, Christina back with the kid seems like kind of calculated too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Sort of like the soft in the whole thing.
And he does have this moment where he kind of lays it out as far as how he sees things. You know, like, Jamie is confronting him about all the terrible and wrong shit that he's done. And he says, there's no such thing as right or wrong.
Right.
No such thing as fair or normal. These are words men invented to scare and shame other men from taking back what they've stolen. And he's got this big grudge against John, obviously, because he's taken his boy and screwed up his life in some way. So in that way, you see exactly where he's coming from. And in some ways, you don't fault them, but they're the main characters, for sure. And you gotta kind of side with them.
Totally. At the same time, I still think there's maybe more at play here, and that maybe he's being like, he's got a longer tail game of manipulation going on.
Yeah,
and he's sort of telling Jamie what he wants to hear, and he's trying to like emotionally gaslight Jamie. Like, I don't really trust that character yet, and I think that like this all feels like some long tail plan that I think will probably come to a head at the end. Although, but that speech that brought up, I think, was really great, because it also just feels like something that John Dutton would say, or that any one of these characters would say, you know?
Yeah, it's a very Yellowstone quote.
for sure. And you know what's really interesting? I'm realizing that I was looking on the Wikipedia page on who's directing what, and, you know, who's writing what. And Taylor Sheridan's writing all of this season by himself. He wrote all of last season by himself, and he wrote most of the first season by himself, and he only had a little bit of help. So I guess I would say a significant amount of help in the second season. And then everything else, he's just done himself, which is kind of a lot for like an executive producer, showrunner, sometimes director to do, you know?
And then you add on 1883, you add on Mayor of East or Kingstown. The guy's, I don't know if he sleeps.
I mean, he's a big fucking deal now in terms of like, he's overseeing three shows, right?
Yep.
And a guy of that stature who's kind of like and he's also like, not only that, he's got the biggest show on television right now, right? On cable television. He's got the number one show, bigger than The Walking Dead and all that. Someone of that ilk usually like just like executive produces and oversees all this stuff, right? This guy's writing all this fucking season, and he's like, I don't know how much he wrote of 1883, but he's definitely, you know, overseeing that and overseeing Mayor of Kingstown. And yeah, it's just a lot for someone of that kind of stature to be doing. So it's kind of interesting.
It's crazy to see him spin all those plates, though.
Yeah. And I'm still like kind of baffled and impressed that he fucking directed every single episode and wrote every episode of the first season.
Yeah,
that's a lot to do. That's 9 episodes, and that's like, you know, and maybe that's why he started handing off directing to other people after that. That's no joke.
No, still, he's got a lot of his hands on the wheel, so he's no shortage of work.
I wonder what's coming in terms of in season 5, because if he's going to have, like, you know, now those two shows are just going on now. They're, you know, one hasn't even aired yet, so he's going to have, by the time season 5 is going, he's going to have 3 shows up in the air. And I wonder if he will start taking a step back in terms of some of the writing and things like that. And or if the show suffers in that regard, because, mm-hmm, you know, someone of this ilk, I'm still shocked that he doesn't.
He's got film projects too in the works.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. He directed a movie and released the movie this year, right? He wrote and directed the one with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah. Which crashing to the ground a bit.
What's that?
That plate did come crashing to the ground.
Right. That movie's not great. I don't think it's necessarily terrible. I just don't think it works.
Right.
Yeah. To do like, and you got to imagine that while that movie was coming while it was being, you know, edited and getting ready, because it came out in May of this year, mm-hmm. you got to imagine that they were shooting and editing and getting, like, you know, 1883 and Mayor of Kingstown ready as well, right? So it's pretty fucking impressive, you know?
Yeah.
As much as Travis Wheatley, his horse trainer character, is not impressive. And the more and more I think about it, I just really can't stand that character. It's still impressive.
Yeah. Not a lot of Travis in this one. So
and for comparison, just so you know, Taylor Sheridan also directed the pilot of Mayor of Kingstown, one other episode, and he wrote every episode so far, except for one with Hugh Dillon, the first one who created the co-created the show with him. This guy doesn't fucking sleep, man.
Can't. I don't know how he does it.
I'm going to be very curious to see, the credits probably aren't there yet, but I'm going to be very curious to see how much he is involved in 1883 and how much of it he does himself.
I mean, if anything, that would be the one to kind of let someone kind of put their stamp on and kind of produce.
You would kind of think, right?
Mm-hmm. But who knows? Who knows? He might just be that guy that is Superman and is able to do all of it. I guess we should probably throw it to the conversation with Jefferson White.
Yes, that's so cool that you got to do that. I'm really excited for people to hear that. We got our first guest on the show, and it's Jimmy. And so, yeah, Mike's going to have a cool conversation with him, and hope you guys enjoy it. And hopefully we have more in store soon.
Absolutely. Keep on Yellowstoning. I want to thank Jefferson White for joining the podcast to discuss all things Yellowstone, both the hit show in which he plays the lovable Jimmy Herdstrom and the brand new official Yellowstone Companion podcast, which hits podcast apps on December 9th. Jefferson, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to what I would refer to myself as a humble, unofficial Yellowstone podcaster.
Thank you so much for taking the time, Mike. I'm new to podcasting, so I'm very excited to learn from you over the course of this conversation.
I've brought a PowerPoint that we can kind of show off and do the how-tos and all that.
Lots of PowerPoints in the Wild West, I'm learning.
Exactly.
No, mostly PowerPoints.
Yeah. A lot of pictures of horses, but not actual horses.
Yeah. One day I hope to actually, you know, spend some time on a horse.
The CG is really great on the show, by the way. You know, you never know. But I do want to dive in just right away by saying, and I've said it before on our little Yellowstone podcast discussions, Jimmy's one of my favorite characters on the whole damn show. He's very much kind of like the beating heart in a show that has characters either deliberately without one or actively suppressing one. I guess thank you for knocking Jimmy out of the park and all that jazz.
Thanks, man. That's so kind of you. It's funny, you know, the actor's kind of the last part of that equation. So I really, all credit goes to Taylor, who's a brilliant writer and also a brilliant director, who sort of is an incredible at, you know, drawing performances from a rock, you know, and in that case, I am that rock. So Taylor and the, you know, and everybody involved in the show creates an environment that is so immersive and so sort of full and living that as an actor, it's incredibly easy just to step into that world and you kind of can't help but be swept along in it, you know?
Yeah. But let's take it like super back to the beginning. How did Jimmy even like come to your, you know, your desk, as it were? You know, was it offered to you? Were you kind of like jumping at the chance to dig into it?
So I got sent, I was working on a TNT show called The Alienist, and I was in a hotel in Budapest, Hungary. And I got sent the script, the pilot script for Yellowstone by my agents. And I read the script and was immediately sort of obsessed with it. So I've been a fan of the show since the moment I read the first page of that script. But my initial, you know, my agents, they believe in me very much. They're incredibly talented. They're great at what they do. They were sending me in for the role of Casey, which, you know, reading that script, this guy is an ex-Navy SEAL. He's the ultimate badass. He's an incredible sort of hard scrabble cowboy. I was reading it and the entire time I was thinking, wow, this is, they are really, they believe in me very much. But I kind of knew it wasn't the right fit. And I was reading the script sort of, you know, I loved the script so much that I wanted to find where I could fit in this world. And Jimmy was a character that I sort of immediately connected with and immediately saw myself in. You know, I saw myself in Jimmy from the very first time I read that script. So I sent my agents a audition tape for Casey, which thankfully time will bury, you know, which thankfully it will become a fossil.
But I'm hoping to see that one day.
I made my own tape for Jimmy prior to being sent an audition for it or anything. I just said, hey guys, I think, you know, Casey, this is an incredible part. This is an incredible series. I really want to be a part of it. What do you guys think about this character, Jimmy? And I sent them a tape for that also. And so that was also, you know, at that point, my main sort of priority was being a part of the show. So it's very funny. I sent them a tape for Jimmy, and I also said, okay, guys, I'm just looking at this script for anywhere else that I could fit in here. So I remember also making a tape for the helicopter pilot in episode one, who flies John Dutton's helicopter. And I think they actually got a real helicopter pilot to play that part.
Suppose that makes sense.
Also wasn't exactly the right fit. But then, you know, three or four audition tapes later, I flew from Budapest to Park City, Utah to meet with Taylor for an audition that lasted about 15 minutes. It was like a 15-hour flight for like a 15-minute audition. And I'm just incredibly grateful. You know, 4 years later, I'm just incredibly grateful to be along for the ride.
And you're not necessarily supposed to be the cowboy type right up front when you join. But, you know, obviously he's got to ramp up pretty quickly. How much training and how demanding is the role when you're getting into it?
It's very demanding. And honestly, this is the kind of thing, it's a little bit like, you know, Olympic gymnasts. If you don't start this when you're young, you're always going to be behind. So starting, you know, the first time I rode a horse was in preparation for Yellowstone season one. And the gift that we have is we have incredible horse trainers on set. We have incredible horses on set, truly the best horses and the best trainers and wranglers in the world. So they gave me a crash course. I was given a crash course like by the best and sort of most, the best teachers too, people who have been teaching riders and teaching horses their whole lives. But that said, you know, I'm very lucky that Jimmy's not supposed to be good at it. All they had to do was get me up there and get me confident enough that I wouldn't get hurt.
Yeah,
and then from there, we're lucky that Jimmy's not supposed to be an expert. And I've had 4 years to sort of try to catch up to the moment that Jimmy's in now, where he is really sort of finally, for the first time, gaining some confidence on a horse and really sort of deepening his practice.
Yeah. Have you ever had to take one of those buck offs or anything like that? Because that does not look pleasant.
It doesn't look pleasant. I have an incredibly talented stuntman and real life rodeo cowboy, Bobby Roberts, who does the bucking sequences, and he's amazing. And I've learned so much from him in so many ways, but every time I have to watch him get bucked off, it's brutal, man. He's amazing. And you know, part of the job for those stunt performers is making it look bad, but he's really good at his job. He really makes it look bad every time. Bobby Roberts is, he's been playing Jimmy as long as I have. His first day was my first day, which was the scene in season one where Jimmy gets duct taped to the horse. That was Bobby's first day. And it was my first day, which was a real trial by fire.
Yeah, man. I also, like this past weekend, I don't know if this is the first time it aired, I saw the Tecovas ad during the last episode. You said you have to warm up to play this role. And I'm wondering, as someone who's, I'm 36, going on 37, but I could definitely see needing like a whole day to warm up for this. So do you have like a routine, or how long does it take?
I've got a little routine that has developed over time. And I'm also, you know, the main thing I'm doing is I'm always watching the other cowboys, watching how they sort of prep, you know? Mm-hmm. So I talk a lot to 4E J. Smith, because 4E's been doing this his whole life. He was a rodeo cowboy. He rode bucking horses for a long, long, long time. So I always watch for them for sort of how they take care of themselves, how they take care of your bodies, because it takes a real toll on your body, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when you're new to it. A lot of it is just muscles that you don't use anywhere else in your life. A lot of it is like muscles and sort of positions that it takes a long time for your body to get used to. So there's, you know, warming up helps a little bit, but on the, you know, there's only so much warming up you can do, and you just have to you have to settle in and expect a certain amount of discomfort and expect a certain amount of pain. I was talking to a friend of mine who started writing recently, who said, you know, how long does it take? And the truth is, it takes a lifetime. And I'm about 4 years into that, and it still beats the hell out of me every time.
Yeah. Yeah. From what all the cowboys on the show say, I don't think it ever stops. So
I think that's right. Yeah. Yeah. Or you get to the point where riding a horse is comfortable and walking isn't comfortable anymore on the other side of it, you know, 40 years into it, which is a trade, you know, it's a trade you got to make.
You know, the characters that you're around a lot, the bunkhouse boys, as it were, that's kind of almost it's a show within the show. At first, it kind of felt almost like Sons of Anarchy dropped in the middle of a ranch. And I mean, do you feel like it's its own little environment on set? How does it feel, one, going into that and now moving away from it and being kind of in this whole other situation this season?
Yeah, that was an incredible gift from the very beginning, because me, Ian Bowen, and Denham Richards were really a unit from the very beginning, from our first days in Montana in season one. We were sort of learning together, riding together, also kind of living together, basically, you know, spending most of the day together, hanging out every day anyway. And that's been an incredible gift, just to have that sort of community, because especially working on a show like this, we're all very far away from home. We're all very far away from our families, our sort of normal lives. So having those guys to lean on and being able to sort of take care of each other from the beginning has been an incredible gift. And then I think that also really feeds into the atmosphere of the show. You know, those guys live together. The characters live together. They live in one big room together, the bunkhouse. So the more that, you know, me and Ian and Denham sort of connected early on, I think that only really helped the world of the show feel authentic and feel true to life. And then since then, it's been incredible. These new characters sort of coming into the bunkhouse, obviously Jin Landon, Teeter, has been an incredible infusion of energy. And her experience sort of getting to kind of relive the experience of joining the bunkhouse through her experience of it. Eden Brolin, who plays Mia, and Hassie Harrison, who plays Laramie, getting to sort of these new infusions of energy have only added to that atmosphere and made it such a blast. Like, those scenes are so, so fun to film. And then moving into season four, when Jimmy gets effectively banished from the bunkhouse, banished from his life at the Yellowstone, kind of ostracized, that stuff felt, you know, helpfully terrible. It felt terrible to feel outside of that community that I had spent 3 years worming my way into, to be suddenly locked out of that was an incredibly painful experience. You know, it really mirrors my experience of no longer getting to participate in those scenes, in watching those scenes from afar, really mirrors Jimmy's experience of being locked out of that world that he loves so much. And the only sort of family, the only family he has, you know.
Anyone you're particularly missing the most? Yes, I'm asking you to pick a favorite of all your cast members, and they're going to hear it.
Boy, pick a favorite. I wish I could. If I had to pick a favorite, I'd say my favorites are Ian Bowen, Denham Richards, Jin Landon, Eden Brolin, Hassie Harrison, Ryan Bingham, Corey J. Smith, Ethan Lee, Jake Ream. I mean, the good news is that, you know, I still get to hang out with all those folks outside of the show, and those are all lifelong friends at this point. Right now I'm staying in a house in Fort Worth, Texas with Jin Landon, because we're down here prepping for a charity cutting event that Carity, which is a breast cancer organization, an incredible organization that provides a lot of support, logistical support, material support to women living with breast cancer. So we're down here prepping for a cutting event in Fort Worth right now, you know, so these are all my lifelong friends, regardless of whether we get to spend time together on the show.
On the most recent episode, yesterday's, I believe it was, you kind of ride off into the sunset, you know, 20,000 acre ride, your hat flies off, there's no more Yellowstone on you. How, you know, can you tease what's coming, or, you know, how did that feel to kind of, was that intentional, the hat thing, or is that just kismet?
God, I wish I could tell you that was intentional. I wish I was a good enough rider that I could make my hat fly off on purpose. That was, you know, it was a funny sequence, because Jimmy's got his backpack on. He's got all of his worldly possessions with him. He's got this backpack on, and he's got this duffel in his right hand, and I've got the reins in the other hand. And then my hat starts flying off and I realize, all right, what am I going to drop here? I'm not going to drop the reins. I'm not going to drop my duffel bag with all my possessions in it. I guess we got to let the hat go. And then they left it in the edit, which was brutal of them to let me look. No, they're always letting me look like a doofus on camera, which is important. It's important character building, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was so perfect for the character in the moment. It's just like,
yeah, he's got this Dutton Ranch cap, right? And the Dutton Ranch cap goes flying off as he rides into his new life on the Sixes.
Couldn't have planned it better.
Yeah. So let's say, tell you what, edit all of that out. And let's say, yes, they made my hat
worked
fly
for days
off using a series of wires, special effects.
And like you were kind of alluding to at the beginning, you get to, I mean, you've spent a lot of time, you know, digging into Taylor's dialogue, Taylor Sheridan, but, you know, on the most recent episodes, you've gotten to like do one-on-one scenes with him. What makes both him so great as kind of like an acting scene partner and a writer that makes his dialogue style so appealing and just down to earth?
He has an incredible sort of holistic approach to filmmaking that I've never encountered it before. And I think, you know, his background is as an actor and an acting teacher, and he's also an incredible screenwriter. He's also an incredible director. He has like immersed himself, you know, like when you start cowboying, you learn that it's not just riding the horse, it's caring for a horse, it's training a horse, it's saddling a horse. It's sort of, and he has a similar approach to filmmaking. He knows about every department. He knows everybody's job on set. And so that's an incredible gift. And I think it gives him a really unique sort of perspective on everybody's responsibility on a set. And it really makes him sort of unique as a creator. But the other thing he's great at, he's also an incredible actor, and he's good at switching off his brain in every other role. Like, he's not trying to direct a scene from inside it. He's not trying to rewrite the scene from inside it. He's amazing at sort of having such a comprehensive understanding of the process, but also being an incredibly present scene partner who's able to sort of operate on impulse and really be in the moment with you. He's an incredible improviser. One thing that I really admire about him as a director and as a writer is the freedom that he allows to his collaborators. He sort of gives us the opportunity to improvise. And then if we're fucking it up, he'll come in and tell us, and he'll sort of steer us in the right direction. But that really, to me, is indicative of an actor who's operating on impulse. If you can turn and throw out a line, if you can turn and respond to something in the moment that's not scripted, that means you're really operating from a place of impulse, and you're really in the world that you've created. So he has the incredible gift also of being able to turn off his director brain, turn off his writer brain, and just be present in a scene, which is amazing and very, very difficult to do.
Let's jump into the podcast of it all, because I know you're doing, like I said, the Yellowstone Official Companion podcast, which sounds really great. And not that I'm jealous or anything, but I think you got set up in Vegas to record this thing or whatever it was. I mean, when I'm in my bedroom here, just kind of doing my home office thing, how did this come about? Was it your idea? How'd the Vegas come about? What's going on here?
Yeah, so the podcast is sponsored by The Win, which is an incredible gift. They have an amazing facility there. They have this brand new podcast studio, basically. And they're taking incredibly good care of us. It's my first time in Vegas. I'd never been to Vegas before. Mm-hmm. And so working on the podcast has been an incredible introduction to that world. And I'm so, so, so grateful that they've been so supportive, and they've provided us with so many incredible resources to make the podcast sound and look and sort of be as good as possible. So I'm very, very grateful for that. That said, I'm also pretty new to podcasting. You know, the whole experience is quite new to me. So I'm trying to approach it in the same way that I approach my experience on Yellowstone, which is, this is a world I'm new to, and every day is an opportunity to learn. Every day is an opportunity to watch and learn from the experts that I'm surrounded by, you know? So I'm very grateful for this opportunity to you. And not, you know, all jokes aside, this is a huge learning experience for me to sort of watch how you're, you know, the way you're sort of guiding this conversation, to sort of watch what threads you're picking up on and then following. That's a sort of a really invaluable learning experience for me, because this whole thing is just learning, you know? And the amazing thing that the podcast affords me is the opportunity to have these long conversations with collaborators on the show, these other actors who I admire so much, whose work I've got to watch, and I've gotten to know these people as, you know, actors and as friends, and to sort of dig into their process and really learn from them in a concentrated way. So I'm trying to approach the whole thing in the same way that I approach Yellowstone, which, okay, this is an opportunity to learn. It's an opportunity to learn more from these geniuses that I find myself lucky enough to be surrounded by.
Yeah. How did it get brought to you? If you don't mind me asking, you said you're not really experienced with podcasts at all.
Yeah. The folks at 101 Studios, who are one of the producers of Yellowstone, David Glasser over there, they're brilliant producers. They're incredibly prolific. And I think what they wanted to do basically with this podcast was dig into the world and sort of community and culture that surrounds Yellowstone. You know, they wanted to do something that wasn't a recap show, but was rather a sort of exploration of the themes and community and culture and sort of authentic world that surrounds the show. And, you know, how they wound up going with me, anytime somebody hires me, it's an absolute mystery. And it's a happy mistake as far as I can tell, anytime somebody hires me. But, you know, I think I'm right for this in the sense that I'm eager to learn from the experience. You know, I'm eager to learn from these actors. I'm eager to learn from the members of the creative team that I get to talk to as part of the podcast. And so I think that makes me sort of uniquely suited to it, is that I'm a young guy who's hungry to learn. And this podcast feels like an opportunity in the same way that I think, you know, part of the function of Jimmy on Yellowstone is to give the audience this character that doesn't know what the fuck is going on, this sort of outside view, this like outside eye on the Dutton Ranch and what goes on there. I think the podcast maybe offers the same opportunity, is that I can be a bit of an audience member myself. I'm a huge fan of the show myself, and I can sort of offer the audience a kind of uneducated layman's approach to talking to these brilliant, you know, creatives.
Very cool. Well, I'm very much looking forward to hearing it and all the interviews that come along with it and the deep dives. And I'm also very much looking forward to seeing what, you know, Jimmy's journey is going to be. Does he cowboy up? Does he die trying? What's going to happen? But either way, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you taking the time. And I'm listening to your podcast as part of my prep for doing that.
Very nice.
Thank you so much for doing so much work in this space and giving fans exactly what they want. You know,
it was born out of passion, man. We love the show. So it just kind of, we were going to talk to each other, or we could record talking to each other about it.
That's smart. Thank you so much. It also is really like, anytime I talk too much about the show, or I get too much up my own ass about, you know, my role in the show, the important thing to remember is that the fans and the community are the reason we get to do the show. Like, the whole reason we get to do this is because people have responded to it, and people, by watching the show and talking about it, they also that's why we get to keep doing it, basically. So we owe everything we have, and we owe every opportunity we get to folks like you who watch the show and who are so sort of committed to it. So thank you. Thank you very much.
No problem. Again, everybody, Yellowstone, the companion podcast, hits apps on December 9th. Jefferson, thanks so much.
Cheers, brother. Talk to you soon.